This time they were not communicating telepathically among themselves, because I heard a weird incoherent mumbling sound coming from them. However, I didn't see their mouths move. I remembered calling them Marcianos, Martians. They revealed, telepathically, in Spanish, that they don't like being called Martians but prefer to be called creatures. When I got up the next morning, I still had pain on the right side of my abdomen, but no mark was visible. Since Maria's daughter had moved to Pennsylvania, Maria again shared a bedroom with her husband. He keeps telling me to wake him up when it happens, but I could not move or speak. Many times he stays awake at night, but nothing happens, so he falls asleep. I do, however, feel or have a sense when they're around. It is important to be noted here that I've had ovarian cancer, and have had several operations to remove parts of my intestine. I also had several operations for breast cancer. I flew occasionally to New York City to see my private doctors, since here on the island private doctors are reluctant to accept Blue Cross, GHI, and Blue Shield, which I got from my husband's retirement. I was informed by my doctors in New York that the cancer had returned and that I urgently need another operation. I used to be in constant stomach pain and noticed blood in my stool and urine when I went to the bathroom. It was not the first time, the cancer has recurred before and they operated on me after each recurrence. But after the encounter with those creatures on April 28, 2006, I returned to New York, several tests were performed, and no cancer was detected. The pain and bleeding had stopped. I truly feel that those creatures had cured me. What is my opinion of those creatures? They could be benevolent and compassionate creatures, but I'm afraid of them. They do not have my permission to do with my body whatever they please. Although I believe they had cured me, I am not their guinea pig. I have something in my right lower back that has been bugging me for a long time. It moves when I touch it and I know it wasn't there before. I saw on the History Channel the program called UFO Hunters, when Mr. Bill Bernays took a man who was abducted by a UFO to Dr. Roger Lear. The man had an alien implant in his leg. When Dr. Lear put a powerful magnet where the man had the implant, to our amazement the object inside his flesh moved toward the magnet and the skin bulged. Like that man, I don't have an entry wound or scar where the object is. That prompted me and my husband to do the same experiment. Unfortunately, we do not have a powerful magnet. The mark on my left hand and the object embedded in my back have been noticed by me since my encounter with those aliens on April 28, 2005. On June 11, 2008, at 2:52, Maria was alone in her living room when she suddenly had a presentiment that she should go outside onto the balcony. There it was again, she reports. My camcorder was not in the immediate area, but luckily I had my cell phone with me. It appeared to be a saucer-shaped object, similar to the ones I've seen previously, but with lights around it. You can hear the crickets and the caw small frogs, chirping, mixed with the sound that the object is making. The sound is similar to the humming of other UFOs I've heard and seen before. It was over the wooded mountains near the other house I moved to in Aguada. What happened to me and my family is no hoax, Maria concludes in the report she sent me. It was a terrifying experience. To prove this, I'm willing to submit to a polygraph test, go under hypnosis, be under oath, or whatever. 7. In September 2009 I received a personal communication from Maria which provides some additional information. We do not live in Aguada anymore, we moved to Aguadilla, nearby. We moved from one house to another house in Aguada, but they followed me, Maria began. This is the third house that we've moved to on the island since we came here from New York City in 2005. At first, I was so afraid that I wanted to return to New York, but now I know that no matter where I move to, they'll find me, so I've decided to remain on the island. However, my daughter was so traumatized that she refuses to come to Puerto Rico, even on vacation. 8. In 2011, at my request, Maria and Nelson sent me an update on the family's experiences. Even with neighbors nearby in a nice community and my husband sleeping beside me, on April 3, 2009, At approximately 3:30 a.m., I found myself in the same room I was in when abducted on November 3, 2007, Maria wrote. The room I entered was almost dark. They showed me a little girl who appeared to be about 1.5 years old, and informed me that the little girl sitting there in the corner was my child. When I looked at her, she did look a lot like my daughter, Barbie, with long, dark, curly hair and her face shaped like my daughter's face. The only difference was the eyes that were tilted upwards, slanted like the creature's. It appeared as though they did not want me to get close to her. I could only see her physique. She was skinny, very thin, and kneeling in a corner, and her eyes looked sad. Is it possible that on November 3, 2007, a fetus was being ejected from my womb, then 1 year and 5 months later they had shown me the child? I don't know. But, before I was abducted on that date, I did feel something moving in my abdomen from side to side. On March 16, 2010, Maria drove her 27-year-old niece, Carmen J. Velez, who was visiting from New York, to her sister's house in Aguada. That night, at about 12:10 a.m., we took a shortcut back home through an isolated wooded road, Maria recounted. Suddenly, the car began shaking, though there was no wind. I told my niece that we wouldn't be able to make it home and that we would have to turn back. I turned around and parked not far from a house to check on the tires. When I exited the car, to my surprise, the front tires looked as if they were torn into 100 pieces, as if they had been sliced with a razor blade. The tires were about 4 months old and were not worn. I then tried to call my sister's house for help on my cell phone. The signal was good, but I couldn't get through. I'm used to calling my sister from that location and I've never had any problems, but that night I couldn't get through. I entered the vehicle, told my niece to lock all the doors, and told her that we had to do whatever it takes to move from there. When I turned on the car, it started okay, but when I put it in drive it didn't move forward. Suddenly, we heard a loud humming sound coming from above the car. My niece was terrified and became hysterical, yelling, "Auntie, it's above us, please don't get out of the car." I was also scared, but wanted to calm her down. Just when I told her not to worry, we suddenly heard a loud roar, like a wild animal or something, coming from across a field. That really frightened us. In desperation, I had no choice but to put the vehicle in drive again, and this time it moved forward. We proceeded at 5 miles an hour to my sister's house, running on 3 tires and 1 front metal rim. Further events ensued. And my daughter Barbie wanted to spend the holidays with us here in Puerto Rico since my son is in the army, stationed in Afghanistan. My husband and I let them both sleep in our bedroom. On November 22, 2010, at approximately 1 a.m., my daughter entered the bathroom to take a bath first, while Leslie sat on the bed. While watching television, she saw with the corner of her eyes something or someone behind the balcony doors, which appeared to be an entity, similar in appearance to the grey aliens but about 5 to 6 feet tall. The alien was on the balcony looking inside the bedroom through the glass panels. Leslie just sat there mesmerized. She couldn't move or yell. It was like being hypnotized. When Barbie came out of the bathroom, Leslie snapped out of it and explained what she had seen. Barbie said that she thought she had seen something standing there on her way to the bathroom. Suddenly, during their conversation, the curtains on the window, which also faces the balcony, began to curl upward, twisting and tying themselves into a knot, tucking themselves into the blinds. The window was closed and there was no wind. The girls became hysterical. Leslie called me on a cell phone, waking me up, and told me to come over quickly. I banged on my husband's room door. He opened the balcony door, proceeded outside onto the balcony, but nothing was seen. When we awoke the following morning, said Leslie, we found we had bruises on our bodies, mainly on our legs. Maria had pointed them out to us, but we had not even realized they were there, but they were black and blue and about 2 or 3 inches in size, mainly on our thighs, and I had one that had a lump right on my knee. We were curious as to how they got there. 9. I think it is fair to say that those beings have tagged, branded, and are actively tracking abductees like myself, concludes Maria in an earlier report. They're quite awful creatures and have no regard for humanity and animals living on Earth. To them, we're just a science project. I could be wrong, but I think the creatures cured my cancer because they need a healthy specimen for their experiments. I don't know if they come from another planet and flew here in spaceships, but what we saw and heard was something we've never experienced before, until we moved to Puerto Rico. I am a Christian, and I do believe in our Lord Jesus Christ. Like most Hispanics, I am also Catholic, however, my family and I feel that what occurred in that house is nothing spiritual, religious, occult, voodoo, Santeria, etc. Moreover, we are not superstitious. The whole family confronted a terrifying experience in that house. We know what we saw and heard is the truth, and I could swear on the Holy Bible that it's true. Evidence. Although Maria Rivera has produced evidence to support her abduction claims, none of this will satisfy the skeptics. What proof is there that any of the abductees have actually been abducted? One witnessed case of a person being abducted took place in Puerto Rico in 1979, and was investigated by Jorge Martin and a colleague. At about 9 o'clock one November morning, Hector Maldonado, a resident of Ponce on the southwest coast, was jogging near the saltings and mangrove thickets of Ponce Salt, close to the sea. Suddenly he noticed five or six strange, thin creatures, varying from 5 to 6 feet in height, with large, bald heads. Their big almond-shaped eyes appeared to be illuminated with bright lights. They had thin necks and long arms, and long hands and fingers, Maldonado told the investigators. I didn't note how many fingers, I was too shaken to notice. Their skin was a grayish-blue color. I couldn't see any clothing on them, and, to me they looked naked, though I spotted no sign of genitals. The astonishing thing was that they had gotten hold of a man and were taking him away. He was a human, olive-skinned, about 5 feet, 9 inches in height, with lank black hair, and apparently unconscious. He looked as if he was petrified, with his eyes closed, and they had gotten hold of him by the armpits. They appeared to be very strong, because two of them were lifting him off the ground with ease. He wasn't even dragging his feet. I didn't get a clear view of his face. I don't think he would have been more than 30. He was slim, and wearing a two-piece suit with a check pattern. The man was unconscious or dead. I imagine unconscious. Behind the beings, above the sea, a bit beyond the mangroves, there was a machine hanging stationary in the air. It looked more or less oval in shape, with a cupola on top, its sides sort of fluted or grooved, and on the top it had a narrow, curved projection with lots of lights. The thing was of a silvery metallic color, and really big, just hanging there in the air, not making a sound. Suddenly one of the creatures, who had been kneeling on the ground, got up and made a sign to Maldonado, who had continued jogging. And then I felt something as if it were inside my mind, like a voice, and, coming seemingly from that being. I heard him say jestingly to the others, "Look at that one, how he's running." And then the being himself started running, making fun of me. I got the impression that he said, "Now, just look how I run," and started moving at a fantastic speed. Then he halted beside the others, and I heard him say to them, "We'll take him too." The others replied something like, "Not him, leave him alone." When he was mocking me, I noticed that he had great big, pointed teeth, like a shark's. The creature then threw some sort of cold liquid at Maldonado, hitting him in the chest, which induced a feeling as though his body was swelling up, like a type of cramp. He managed to force himself to escape. I just carried on running, and didn't want to look back. When he finally did look back, the craft, the creatures, and the man were nowhere to be seen. "Didn't you notify the police?" asked the investigators. "No. As I've already told you, I was very scared. I didn't think they would believe me. For a long time I felt bad about what might have happened to that chap they were taking, because I have no doubt whatsoever that they were indeed taking him." 11. Hair of the Alien. In his remarkable book of the above title, leading Australian researcher Bill Chalker, who has a background in chemistry and mathematics, describes his exemplary investigations into what has turned out to be arguably the most convincing case for alien abduction. The witness was Peter Cowery, whose experiences apparently began in 1988, when he was living with his Lebanese parents in a suburb of Sydney, Australia. On the night of July 12, Peter experienced the first instance of being paralyzed by something of unknown origin, becoming aware of three or four ugly figures only about 3 to 4 feet tall beside his bed. He felt a tingling and churning sensation of something that gradually enveloped him, rendering him totally paralyzed. At one stage, two other, different beings appeared, thin, tall, with big black eyes and a narrow chin. Various communications were received telepathically, and Peter sensed warm emotion emanating from them. Finally, a long, flexible crystal tube was inserted into his head and he blacked out. Later, it transpired that he had also had a number of other strange experiences. And in 1992, the most extraordinary and productive encounter took place, which did not come to light until much later. As Bill noted in his diary in 1996, Peter described a highly personal experience he had at home about 2 or 3 years ago, sexual, being forced onto a strange female being, onto its breast. He resisted, then a very strong force pushed him against the breast, he bit a nipple, felt something like a piece of rubber caught in his throat for days, he discovered some very fine wispy hair under his foreskin, he still has one small strand, which he keeps in a plastic bag. He showed this to the two media people and me. The incident had occurred at about 7:30, when he was awake. All of a sudden, two naked females appeared from nowhere. A blonde and a Chinese girl. Very weird looking eyes and color of blonde, as Peter noted in his diary on July 23, 1992. Blonde pushed me to her breast a few times, then I bit her nipple and started coughing. She showed no emotion, blood, or screamed in pain. I went to the toilet and found two hairs under my foreskin. Peter explained to Bill that the women felt uncannily light. The one sitting opposite him sat with her legs tucked under her backside, the other one halfway kneeling, sitting partially upright. The blonde woman appeared to be quite tall and in her mid-30s. Her hair was done up like the wind was hitting it, like it was blown back. She had protruding, very high cheekbones. The nose was long, and a longer face than I was accustomed to in females I know. Her eyes were 2 or 3 times bigger than our eyes. I knew I wasn't looking at a human female. Her mouth, her lips were normal in size, but the chin was pointier. She had average-sized breasts, well-proportioned, and her hair came down to about halfway down her back, and like really high up. It was flimsy. He did not observe any underarm hair, nor did he have an opportunity to notice if there was any pubic hair. The dark-haired woman looked Asian, though her cheekbones were too extreme. The eyes were dark black. When I looked at her, said Peter, I got the impression that she was watching the blonde one and learning how to interact. The Asian woman's face looked more human than the other one, except for the eyes and cheekbones. He noticed that both women had expressionless faces. It was just like looking at someone with glass eyes. Peter told Bill that he didn't know why he had bitten and taken a chunk out of the blonde woman's nipple, other than that it might have been a defensive reaction. There was no blood, there was nothing, no trace whatsoever. He says he swallowed it and it became stuck in his throat for 3 days. Had a sexual act taken place? I don't know what sort of interaction we had, Peter responded. However, given the positioning of the recovered hairs, it would seem likely that some kind of sexual act occurred. The women disappeared as soon as Peter started the coughing fit. 1 minute they were there, the next minute gone. Hypnotic regression sessions were held which yielded further information, tending to reinforce the idea that a genetic agenda lay behind the women's visit. I have only touched on some of the many aspects discussed in Bill Chalker's unique book. Most impressive are the results of the mitochondrial DNA sequence analysis of a shed hair from an alien abduction case by the Anomaly Physical Evidence Group, APEG, in April 1999, a lengthy report which yielded a considerable amount of surprising data. As the biochemistry team leader, Dr. Horace Drew, concluded, this genetic analysis of a reportedly alien, thin blonde hair has raised a number of important questions for further work. It generally supports the reality of such extraterrestrial contacts, in a Sydney suburb in 1992 and perhaps elsewhere, owing to rare morphology of such a hair, plus the rare nature of DNA sequences obtained. Had that hair been a common Earth artifact, it would have shown up early in the investigation. We cannot prove it is an alien hair, yet Occam's razor supports that notion. Where else in Sydney could Peter Carey have obtained a long, clear, exceptionally thin head hair that shows Basque Gaelic DNA in its root, but Chinese DNA in two parts of its shaft? The most logical scenario would seem to be that higher creatures not from Earth have been following Peter's genetics for many years, or perhaps many generations, and that the almost human females he met in 1992 may have taken advantage of such information, for example, a planetary database of human genetics, to select for certain favorable traits in their own reproduction. We have no reliable information about whether non-human or almost human aliens come from, nor how they entered Peter's house. Yet the clear implication is that humanoid or near-human life forms can be found elsewhere in our galaxy, and that at least some of them are close enough to us genetically to interbreed without any fertility barrier. Indeed, the tall blonde alien reported by Peter Carey in 1992 bears a close resemblance to the short blonde alien reported by Antonio Villas-Boas in 1957. 12. A fully recollected abduction. With regard to the aforementioned iconic abduction in Brazil, the first such case to come to public attention. 13. A resume is warranted here, based largely on the detailed, and lesser known, deposition provided by the witness to Dr. Olavo Fonts, a medical doctor and internationally respected researcher, 4 months after the event. Unlike the majority of abductions that began to proliferate on a vast scale at this time, the abductee in this case had total recall of the event. On the night of October 15/16, 1957, near São Francisco de Sales in the state of Minas Gerais, Brazil, 23-year-old Antonio Villas-Boas was plowing a field when a bizarre-looking machine with blinding lights landed nearby, stalling his tractor. 4-5-foot-tall humanoids emerged from the craft, dressed in tight-fitting overalls and helmets, from the top of which 3 silvery tubes ran backwards. Only their light-colored eyes could be seen through the goggles they were wearing. They grabbed Antonio and dragged him, struggling, aboard the craft via a ladder, communicating with each other in peculiar slow barks and yelps. Another male humanoid was on board. Prior to being introduced to the woman, Antonio was divested of his clothes, sponged down with a thick, clear liquid, then led to a room where he remained alone for half an hour or so, after which a grayish smoke exuded from small metallic tubes in the wall, causing him to vomit. A naked woman, about 4.5 feet tall, then entered. She had very fair, almost bleached hair reaching halfway down her neck, vivid blue Chinese-type eyes, higher cheekbones, making the face look wide but narrowing sharply and terminating in a pointed chin, thin, barely visible lips and rather small ears, high and well-separated breasts, a thin waist and small stomach, wide hips and large thighs, with very red underarm and pubic hair. A sexual act took place twice during the over-four-hour period spent on board. Finding her ugly, Antonio was later at a loss to understand how he could have gone through with it. At one stage, he attempted to purloin a heavy, clock-like instrument to furnish proof of his experience, as the men sat on swivel chairs in the cabin, their attention momentarily engaged elsewhere. As quick as lightning, he said, one of the men jumped up and, pushing me aside, snatched it from me angrily. Finally, he was taken by one of the men on a guided tour around the exterior of the craft, along a sort of catwalk that encircled it, terminating in front near a large semi-projecting thick sheet of glass elongated towards the sides and stoutly embedded in the metalwork. The craft appeared to be about 35 feet long and 23 feet wide. 10-foot-long metal shafts functioned as undercarriage. Two square projections protruded from each side and three large metal spurs were fixed horizontally, see sketch below. Set vertically in a rear platform was a rectangular piece of metal, which he thought might have acted as a rudder, and what looked like a huge cupola could be seen rotating slowly, illuminated by greenish fluorescent light. Even with that slow movement, Antonio reported, you could hear a noise like the sound of air being drawn in by a vacuum cleaner, a sort of whistle. Pointing to a ladder near the entrance, the guide indicated to him that he should descend it. When I was down on the ground, I looked up. He was still there. Then he pointed to himself and then pointed to the ground, and finally to the sky toward the south. Then he made a sign for me to step back and disappeared into the machine. The metal ladder now began to get shorter, the steps arranging themselves one above the other. The lights of the metal spurs and of the headlamps and of the revolving dish all became brighter, while the dish was spinning faster and faster. Slowly the craft began to rise, vertically. At that moment the sound also increased, and turned into a veritable hum or loud whine. The three shafts of the tripod on which it had been standing rose toward the sides. The lower part of each leg, narrower, rounded, and ending in an enlarged foot, began to enter the upper part, which was much thicker and square, and when that was finished, the top parts began to enter the base of the machine. Finally, there was no longer anything to be seen there. The base was smooth and polished as though that tripod had never existed. The craft continued to rise slowly in the air until it had reached a height of some 30 to 50 meters. There it stopped for a few seconds, and at the same time its luminosity began to get still greater. The whirring noise of the air being displaced became much more intense and the revolving dish began to turn at a fearful speed, while the light changed through various colors until it was vivid red. At that moment the machine suddenly changed direction, with an abrupt movement, making a louder noise, a sort of beat. Then, listing slightly to one side, it shot off like a bullet toward the south, and was gone from sight in a few seconds. In the days following the encounter, Antonio suffered from a variety of after effects, including excessive drowsiness, though he was unable to sleep for the first two nights, nausea, a pounding headache, loss of appetite, irritation of the eyes, itchy lesions on the arms and legs, and two yellowish patches, one on each side of his nose. In February 1958 he was given a complete medical examination by Dr. Fonz in Rio de Janeiro. Among his findings were two small hyperchromatic patches, one on each side of his chin, from where the blood samples had been taken, and various cutaneous lesions and scars. These physical symptoms, stated Fonz, suggest radiation poisoning or exposure to radiation, but unfortunately he came to me too late for the blood examination that could have confirmed such a possibility beyond doubt. 14. During his first public appearance, on a Brazilian television show in 1978, Vilas Boas recapitulated his experience and added a significant new detail. During his second sexual encounter on board the craft, he said, the woman put a sample of his semen into a container. 15. Pablo Villarubia Morso, a Brazilian journalist and researcher, learned from Antonio's closest sister, Odersha Vilas Boas, that five Americans dressed in green uniforms, who she thought were from NASA, took Antonio to the United States for interrogation. Some spoke Portuguese. They kept visiting several times over 8 or 10 years, she claimed. They would always give my brother books written in English as gifts. He was subjected to questioning and the lie detector in California, and taken to an open area where the remains of a flying saucer had been found. Then they showed him another, in good condition, inside an enclosed area like a museum, asking him if it was identical to the one he had seen. He told me that it was very similar. He was always accompanied by a bilingual journalist, who had a foreign name and acted as an interpreter, and was always surrounded by uniformed American personnel. He was in the United States for 3 days. They later gave him two properties near San Francisco and San Rafael. I managed to see the deeds. They sent him back to Rio, where he spent between 15 and 20 days in a hospital, undergoing new examinations and tests. 16. Antonia Villas Boas later graduated with a law degree in Brasilia, married, and had four children, practicing with the title of Honorable Magistrate. He died in 1992, standing by the validity of his experience to the end.